So welcome to class number 8, and I'm going to be talking about Nelson Mandela. But first of all, I'm just going to go through a few events which are listed in your booklet on page 77 and 78. I'm not going to go through them all, but I'm just going to comment on some of them, because the importance of Nelson Mandela really fits within one of the absolutely massive events or series of events or currents of events of the 20th century, and that is decolonisation. And decolonisation is not finished today. There's still, you often see headlines around in the newspapers today, how can we decolonise our universities? How can we decolonise our museums? The idea is that although certainly the vast majority of colonies are no longer colonies, the idea is that the effect of colonisation continues until today. So if we look at some of the chronology on page 77, we can see a very key event in 1884. I wasn't quite sure of the date last year when I mentioned it, which was the Berlin Conference, where literally Africa was divided between, not all of it, there was a couple of pieces of Africa which were always independent, but only little ones, between Belgium, France, Denmark, Britain, Germany and Italy. And I mentioned last week that there were no Africans in the room. Now, this turned out, this, of course, all of the colonising powers said, we are doing this in the interests of humanity in general. That's what we would expect them to say, but certainly I don't think anybody reasonable thinks that today. And so the next 100 years or 120 years is the story of how the colonies gradually won, in the vast majority of cases, their independence. And this is partly linked to the industrialization of society and the advance of the complexity of technology. Because whereas if colonizers just want the local people to mine silver with old-fashioned technology or grow tobacco, then it is a little easier to use authoritarian systems to make people continue. However, once you have universities and chemical industries and pharmaceutical industries and computing industries, you need a more every society needs a more educated population. And of course, if you can't start educating people, they say, hey, we don't want to be colonized anymore. And this was certainly a universal question. In India, because the next event listed on this chronology is the establishment of the Indian National Congress. In India, the British colonization was very harsh. And in 1857, there was a huge revolt against British colonial rule. The result was, as is usually the case, massive repression, but also a certain number of small concessions which allowed Indians to become doctors and lawyers and teachers. And so you got a new Indian middle class. And the colonizers were hoping that this would keep the Indian people happy, but in fact the whole thing about lawyers and teachers and poets is they have more intellectual tools to organize a fight for against colonization. And so the foundation of the Indian National Congress in 1885 was in some ways unsurprising, and they will begin to fight for the independence of India. This will take a long time. And indeed, for quite a long time, the people who were in the Indian National Congress wanted autonomy for India, more rights for India, but were not asking for independence. However, as the colonial rule got more and more violent, and especially at the end, just after the First World War, there was a well-known massacre at Amritsar. Incredible massacre, hundreds of people killed on a peaceful demonstration. Eventually, most of the Indian National Congress, or even all the Indian National Congress, said, no, we need independence. And this led to a long series of struggles led by many people, but also especially Mahatma Gandhi, which will eventually lead in 1947 to the independence of India, Pakistan and Bangladesh. India and Pakistan. And Pakistan will later be divided into Pakistan and Bangladesh. So, what else do we have here? In 1901, we have written here that the Australia receives political autonomy. And the fundamental reason for this, which is the same case as New Zealand in 1907, is that among all its many, many colonies, Britain had like 200 colonies, I don't even know the names, but there were different groups of colonies. There were the colonies of settlements, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and of course at the beginning the United States, but then they became independent. So here the basic mechanism was to bring Europeans over in order to build societies. As I'm sure you're aware, the indigenous peoples, the Canadian Indians, as the native Canadians, we would say, and the Aboriginals in Australia had a very rough time of it, partly through violence and partly through disease, because of course they were not immune to European diseases being brought over by the British. But in any case, the British Empire made a distinction between the colonies in Africa and India and Australia, New Zealand and Canada, which were mostly white colonizers, and so they certainly treated them much better. And as you can see, Australia and New Zealand received political autonomy in 1901, and in the 1920s become known as dominions and not colonies. And these are the groups which still today have King Charles as their king. King Charles is the king of Australia. Still today, as you probably know. Now, South Africa was a rather specific case, and I will come to that in a moment. If I jump forward to 1926, we can see the formalisation of the British Commonwealth. It was beginning to become clear that the British Empire would need to adapt if it was going to survive. And the way they did this was by forming something called the Commonwealth, which still exists today, which has a tiny budget but a very important symbolic position, which is apparently an agreement of cooperation between equal partners. Now, of course, it has been massively dominated by Britain, but less so today. Less so today. Today, the British is the British position is much less dominant. The independence of India in 1947, after the long struggle of Mahatma Gandhi, was hugely important. This was the biggest British colony. This was the colony which had made Britain extremely rich. And incidentally, no doubt the most negative thing you can say about British colonisation of India is that the average income per person in India in 1947, when India received its independence, was approximately the same amount of money as 300 years earlier when the British formalised colonisation. That is to say that over 200 or 300 years, where the entire world had moved forward massively, only Britain more than anywhere else, the Indians were no richer than they were at the beginning. But most importantly, in 1947, when India got their independence, it was a shock to the entire world. In every country in Africa, there were groups of people saying, hey, if India can get its independence, maybe we can too. So it was a tremendous encouragement to nationalist organisations everywhere. We use the word nationalist for those groups which want their nation to be independent. When we get to the 1960s, the British elites are becoming very aware that colonization cannot continue. And one of the interesting differences between the British Empire and the French Empire is that the British decolonization happens without a major war. Whereas you will remember that in Algeria, the Algerian War was a huge thing. Now, historians disagree as to why the British managed to decolonize without a major war. Some of the most generous historians say it's because the British elite were more intelligent than the French elite. It's possible, or it may just be luck, of course. But in any case, although there were horrible cases of repression and torture in British Kenya, there was not a war with millions of soldiers like in France and Algeria. During the 1960s, then, a whole series of, 50, 60, 70, 80 British colonies became independent. It was a huge wave of decolonization. You can see there in 1962, Uganda, Jamaica, Trinidad, 1963, Kenya, 1964, Zambia, Malawi, 1966, Barbados, Guyana, Botswana, Lesotho. Yeah, you get the impression, you get the idea, huge numbers becoming independent. And two countries were a bit of an exception in Africa, for particular reasons which I will come to. One of them, but basically the reason was that they had a large white population, very attached to colonial power. Whereas in Kenya or in Uganda, there was a small number of white people who, when some of them stayed and were still there, and got on very well, but there was no. Let's say that once the nationalist movement became powerful, the white minority, they accepted, yeah, that this is the way it's going to go. But in two cases, in Rhodesia, which today is Zimbabwe, notice that Rhodesia, the name of the country, was from Cecil Rhodes, one of the English colonizers from the 19th century. So they actually changed the name of the country. That was one of them, and that continued until the 1980s with terrible repression. And in fact, what happened in Rhodesia is that the white minority, the only people who had the vote, declared independence, but an independence which was intended to continue white domination, no votes for blacks. And the other exception was South Africa, and that is our story for today. So that's where I'm going to move on to the PowerPoint and to this particular case of Nelson Mandela. So I'm going to say a few things about Nelson Mandela and then come back to the question of South Africa and apartheid. So there you have up on the board there pictures of Nelson Mandela, born in 1918, died in 2013, so at the age of 95. When he was young and involved in the movement, many of his friends who were 15 or 16 or 17 were killed in the repression. And I sometimes think that the fact that Mandela had a happy and long retirement was a little bit of a compensation for all the friends that he'd lost when they were very young. Now you see these two pictures, one of him when I think he's about 40, and the other one when he's in his 70s. You will not see any pictures between these two, because he was in prison for 27 years. Not only was he in prison for 27 years, but for the first 20 years he was not allowed to read newspapers. Now, you may not like reading newspapers, But if you're a political activist, there is nothing worse than not being allowed to read newspapers. So it was really terrible, also terrible prison conditions. He was imprisoned in 1962, and 20 years later, in 1982, he was moved to an easier prison, and life got better. But for the first years in prison, a tremendously cruel regime, no newspapers, and their job was to, they had to break stones. It was a really 19th century prison, really. While he was in prison, his mother died, and his son died in a car accident. And he was not allowed to go to the funeral, you know, just to give you an idea. I tend to avoid the very violent bits of a story because I'm rather squeamish, but you can imagine the rest of it, I'm sure. So here he is, and he's an important symbol then of the fight. And of course today he is a bit of a hero. You can even go to see two different musical comedies about Mandela. And now there are not many people who have two different musical comedies written about them. I don't, for example. I'm not necessarily recommending them. I'm just saying that it's a symbol of how important he's become as an icon of successful activism. Because I think one of the reasons many people like Mandela, if you've ever done any activism, you'll know, usually you lose. And from time to time you win, and Mandela won, and apartheid did fall. And so that is something that's very important to people. Now, Mandela is not the only person to have had musical comedies written about him. We also have, here you can see, a musical comedy about Gandhi, and also one about Jesus Christ. So, you know, it can be done. Now, another sign of how influential he is today as a popular symbol. This is the Lycée Nelson Mandela, somewhere in Bourgogne. Again, you know, it's not that easy to have a lycée named after you. A series of films have been made, some of them very good. The first two here, I really recommend. They're really extremely moving and intelligent films where you actually learn a lot about the situation. Invictus is about the time when Mandela became president of South Africa. And Goodbye Bafana is about how he became friends with one of the prison officers, and he was the godfather to the prison officer's child. A very moving thing. One of the impressive things about Mandela is when he was in prison breaking rocks, he decided that he was also going to learn the language of his prison officers, which was Afrikaans. I will explain why in a moment. Certainly he and all his organization always defended the idea that there are several ethnic groups in South Africa and that all of them are welcome. This is important because at the time, I have a personal link to this. I was in the anti-apartheid movement for 10 years when I was in Britain, so I I had the police coming to visit me. I was innocent, but the police came to visit me. What was I going to say about that? We like to have a hero, and so Mandela's become the hero. But of course, to defeat apartheid, there were really hundreds of thousands of people involved, and some of them were killed. We like to have one hero, but that because that's how our modern society works. You know, if you want a good film, how many heroes do you want? Well, one. Or a good novel, you know, one hero, that's the right number. But of course, real life doesn't really work like that. The campaign against apartheid in the 1980s was really very good. This is actually a photograph which I took myself the first day which I arrived in university. And it says, Cambridge investments mean apartheid, disinvest. And it was a campaign to persuade the university, or oblige the university, to stop investing money in South African companies who were profiting from apartheid. South Africa became the big political issue of the 1980s. Just like today, Gaza is the big political issue of today. Mandela also got songs written about him. I'm sure you've heard one or both of these, Free Nelson Mandela, and I've forgotten the one by Johnny Clegg. It's extremely well known. Asimbonanga. And there you get the various statues of him. This one is in London, outside South Africa House, outside the embassy. I actually saw Mandela at the embassy, up in the balcony. Oh, there he is! But that was very impressive. Another one, as you can see, it's a rather huge one there. This was in Johannesburg. Now today, Mandela is a bit of a hero. Like, everybody loves Mandela today. But of course, when he represented the desire for the end of apartheid and equality for black and white people in South Africa, and he was in prison for 20 years, then the debate was much wider. And in Britain, you could see this poster in the 1980s, in 1985, when Nelson Mandela was in prison. And as you can see, the slogan is "Hang Nelson Mandela, execute Nelson Mandela." This is a Federation of Conservative Students. You won't find it on the Conservative Party website today. It's like a hidden history, but this is what they were putting around to counter the campaign to free Nelson Mandela. One of the reasons it took so long to get rid of apartheid in South Africa was that South Africa is an extremely rich country, in particularly diamonds and uranium. These are expensive things, and so the campaign was built around opposition to big companies. Barclays Bank was at the centre of financing apartheid companies, and so this is from the campaign to boycott Barclays Bank. One of the popular tactics at the time was to use super glue and to glue the bank machines so that you couldn't use them. Of course, I could not recommend this sort of activity. And there you go. That's the boycott shell piece. Okay, so let me go back into history. And the reason why South Africa turned out to be a rather particular case. Well, first of all, South Africa was the home of a number of African peoples, but the first Europeans to arrive to settle were the Dutch, and the Dutch established a colony in Cape Town in 1652. That's the Dutch from the Netherlands, yeah? 1652. So here you see something of the beginning of the problem, if you like, from a cultural point of view, because this group, by the 20th century, the powerful white minority which dominated South African society had been in South Africa for 250 years. So they couldn't think, oh, well, we can always go home. The Netherlands was not home. It was very, very strong local tribe. And indeed, Mandela always said that the Afrikaner, the Dutch speaking, they are one of the tribes of South Africa. And Mandela always opposed the idea that we want to get rid of the whites. They've been here for 250 years. That's not realistic. Now, the Dutch were not the only white Europeans to colonize South Africa. Also, the English, they occupied Cape Town in the early 1800s during the Napoleonic War. So when the English arrived, the Dutch had already been there for 150 years, and of course the different African peoples had been there for many, many centuries. In the 1830s, the Dutch-speaking settlers moved eastward during a period that they referred to as the Great Trek. And this led them to colonize the eastern regions of South Africa. And they founded two autonomous republics, the South African Republic and the Orange Free State. This great trek and the founding of autonomous republics became one of the founding myths of Afrikaner nationalism and laid the foundations for the Afrikaner rule, which was going to impose apartheid. It also helped solidify their language. That is to say, I've been speaking of the Dutch-speaking colonists, but it's no longer true. After 200 years, their language had changed, and they spoke Afrikaans, which is came from the Dutch, but it's very, very different. So what you had was a white, predominant white community who had their own language and who felt that it was their country, at the same time, of course, as treating the Africans very badly. Then something happened which was very unfortunate for the Africans. In 1866, diamonds were discovered in South Africa. Not two or three diamonds, but millions of diamonds. Yeah, the biggest diamond mines in the world at the time. Suddenly, the British were much more interested in South Africa, and there was the war between the English and the Zulus, and as you can imagine, the technology was rather different, and the English won, and this was the end of Zulu independence in 1879. 20 years later, there was another war, this time between the English and the Boers. Now, the Boers are these Dutch settlers who speak Afrikaans. It's all the same. Afrikaners is the same as Boers at this time. So the Boer War, la guerre des Boers, ce n'est pas entre le demi-sel et le salé, c'est entre, oui, c'était du, d'accord, c'était entre les Anglais et les Africains. Interestingly enough, during this war, concentration camps were invented by the English. The Afrikaner guerrilla resistance was powerful, but the British won the war and obliged all of South Africa to become united and to become, from 1910, the Union of South Africa. Under the domination of the British monarch. I think I have another picture here, maybe. Picture here, there. Yeah, so there you can see the Union of South Africa. After 1931, the Union of South Africa is autonomous, not independent, autonomous, but still under the British monarchy. In 1961, South Africa will become a republic. During the Second World War, English-speaking whites in South Africa and Afrikaners were split about the Second World War. The English-speaking whites obviously wanted to join the war on the side of the British, which the Afrikaners opposed. The Afrikaners were the more powerful of the two white groups, and after the Second World War, the National Party of the Afrikaners won the elections, and they began to impose the system of apartheid. And apartheid is probably similar in a way to the segregation in the south of the United States, but much more rigid. In fact, what they did, and this might remind you of some things happening today in different parts of the world, is they defined everybody in four racial groups: white, black, coloured and Indian. And they said, you know, we have to have towns for white people and towns for black people. And in order to solve the problem of there being far more blacks than whites, solve the problem for them, they decided, they designated small bits of land and said, these are the homelands of the black people. All black people live here. They might come into white South Africa to work, but they come with permission and they have to have a pass. It sounds tremendously like Palestine. They have to have a pass to get in and out. And this is what apartheid was. You had to carry a passport. If you were black, you had to carry a passport. If you were white, you did not have to carry a passport. So the pass laws, as they called them then, required all non-white people to carry passbooks with them. The pass laws stipulated how long, where, and when black people could go. No black person was allowed to remain in a town for more than 72 hours. And resistance to the pass laws led to an enormous series of demonstrations in 1960, enormous series of demonstrations, and that's the most well-known photograph of them. Does anybody know the name of the huge demonstrations in 1960 in South Africa? They're a little bit famous, and I have a little video for you here concerning them. No, nobody knows the name of the town. It is Sharpeville. And here we have a short video about it.
At Sharpeville, an industrial township, thousands gather outside a police station to protest against new laws requiring every African to carry a pass at all times.
Talking peace and non-violence against the government whose blood is on this savage attack on an unarmed defenseless people.
Okay, so that was That was the key moment, although it was a horrific massacre, it was the key moment when the movement... What's happening there?
The law of the country was that.
That was the key moment when across the world the movement against apartheid, which had been a small movement with small meetings or with the same people at every meeting, took off and became very strong. Slowly. But it will be 30 years until Mandela is released. So let's have a look at the other side, the resistance. And this is mentioned in the document that Mandela is part of the African National Congress. Now, the African National Congress, that's Sharpeville. Yeah. The African National Congress is founded in 1912. There you have its founders. It is actually the oldest national liberation organization in Africa. And it was founded just before the Native Land Acts, which formalised the taking over of all the 90% of the land by 15% of the population. Now, at the beginning, the leaders were very moderate. They had some references to Gandhi's non-violent tactic. Tactics. They wrote letters to the King of England, asking the British King to protect the rights of black South Africans. And when the pass laws came in, they organised passive resistance where they refused to use the passes. For example, during the First World War, the African National Congress was loyal to the British Empire. They said, if we support the British Empire, perhaps the British Empire will treat us better after the war. Spoiler, it doesn't work like that. Initially, it only admitted black men as members. It's only in 1943 that women can become members. And it is in the 1940s that the organisation becomes much bigger. In 1947, there are 5,000 members, and apartheid is instituted in 1948. The younger people in the African National Congress began to become impatient, and Nelson Mandela by this time was 22 years old. He was 22 in 1940. And in 1944, He, along with Oliver Tambo, established the African National Congress Youth League to start mass activity and to move away from small group activity and petitions. The African National Congress formed an alliance with the South African Communist Party. In 1950, the South African government passed the Suppression of Communism Act. And this act defined communism extremely widely and allowed the banning of many African National Congress leaders. At this time, the government used the tactic of banning, which is basically a form of house arrest. You're not allowed to leave your home, you're not allowed to meet more than one person at once. So this was very effective. They were allowed to do it without going through a tribunal. Now, slowly, the movement built up around the world. We can see here one of the famous episodes, which is in Ireland, where a group of workers were being disciplined because they refused to sell South African fruits. And they went on strike for 6 months for the right to refuse to sell South African fruit. It was done in stores. There's even a song about it, but I'm not going to play the song now, a song by Christy Moore. In the 1950s, the African National Congress became a mass organization. Its membership went from 7,000 to 100,000. And in 1955, the Congress of the People wrote a Freedom Charter. And the Freedom Charter demanded equal rights regardless of race and served as a blueprint for the ANC's vision of a multiracial society. You can see there then the essential elements of this charter. The people shall govern, all national groups shall have equal rights, the people shall share in the country's wealth, the land shall be shared amongst those who work it, all shall be equal before the law, etc., etc. So you can see the style. They also demanded the nationalisation of minerals. It was after the Sharpeville massacre of 1960, where 69 people were killed, that the African National Congress abandoned the idea of purely passive resistance. And Nelson Mandela was one of the leaders of the new military wing of the African National Congress. That is to say, after many decades of the existence of the African National Congress, and 12 years after the founding of apartheid, there was this establishment of the military wing. Umkhonto we Sizwe, and I do recommend the book if this is something that interests you. This means the spear of the nation, and Mandela explains some of this in the speech. What they decided to do, what did they want to do? So on the one hand, they could see, and I'm going to tell you some of the things he says in the speech. He says, on the one hand, they could see that purely non-violent action, petitions, passive resistance and writing letters to the King of England was not working. On the other hand, they were very unwilling to launch a civil war. But particularly, they were the ANC were the leadership of the Black Liberation Movement. And they were obliged to listen to the anger of the people. And so Mandela says in his speech, we established Umkhonto we Sizwe in order to stop a civil war. Not in order to organise a civil war, but in order to stop a civil war. That is to say that he said that if they organised a specific armed campaign, this would discourage the people who were so angry and desperate. He said that this would stop just a generalised civil war of white against black. So what they decided to do was to launch a sabotage campaign. They got explosives and they exploded power stations, factories. And for the first few years, that is to say that they decided not to assassinate ministers or organize military actions against the army. They decided to concentrate on sabotage. The idea of this was that sabotage can quickly become extremely expensive for the powers that be. They bombed also unoccupied government buildings. There were 200 attacks between 1962 and 1964. There were 200 attacks. And you can see one of them there. Yeah, that's the only picture I could find. The leadership of Umkhonto was in exile for a long time, but by this time Mandela was in prison. So, final bit of introduction, Mandela himself. He was born Rolihlahla Mandela, Rolihlahla Madiba Mandela, in 1918. So, where did he get the name Nelson? Now, I'm sure you know Nelson. He's this guy in stone on the top of a pillar in the middle of Trafalgar Square. Admiral Nelson is a great military leader of the British Empire. So how come that this African liberation leader had the name of an imperialist hero? Well, it's quite simple. When he was young, he was brought up in a village. He spent most of his time looking after sheep. His father was the chief of the local people. Neither of his parents could read or write. So although he actually came from what was considered locally a royal family, but of course royal families, there were a lot of them, one every 10 miles, you know. C'est un peu comme être le maire du village, je crois. Neither of his parents could read or write, although they were part of a kind of elite in a way. But his mother was very Christian, and so they sent him to a local Methodist school. And he was baptized as a Methodist. And the Methodist school was run by a white Methodist teacher who said, "Oh, well, we don't want all these African names. We're going to give you English names." And that's where he got the name Nelson. He was given it by his teacher. So, in a way, he got his name by a traditional racist tradition where African children don't keep their own name. They get given a new name in the Methodist school. He joined the African National Congress in the 1950s. He was married. He had a couple of children. But the first time he went to prison for a few months. And when he came back, his wife had left him. It was too much for her. She was fed up of just being frightened of the police all the time. A couple of years later, he married somebody else who understood that this guy was a political activist, that he wasn't going to do anything else. And this was Winnie Mandela. He was then arrested. He went across Africa to learn from other liberation groups, and in particular he went to Algeria and followed a training course with the Front de Libération Nationale. But when he came back to Africa, he was arrested and he was accused of conspiracy and treason. This is at the moment of the Rivonia trial, and you have been looking at the speech he gave at the trial. The situation of the speech he gave at the trial was he was convinced he was going to be executed. Everybody knew he was going to be executed. So this was this was his last speech. Because of the size of the movements, they were kind of lucky, and so they were only sentenced to life imprisonment, and he spent 27 years in prison. One of the reasons that the government of South Africa accepted this is that they were quite confident that he would die in prison. The conditions were very bad, the food was very bad, the medicine was very bad. They thought, well, okay, we'll not execute him, but he'll die in prison. So in some ways, he was tremendously lucky. Most of his comrades died in prison. And I'll come back to that later. So I'm going to do two things now. First of all, another little video. And then we're going to look at an extract from the speech before I come back to this particular question of what happened later. So what's it called here? Remembering Rivonia.